You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
4 minutes after 8 on the West Coast. Joining me from someplace on the planet, we rarely know where, is Grant Newsham. Grant, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh, fine, thank you.
Where are you?
I'm in Anchorage, Alaska, actually.
So what are you doing there? Speaking? Covering something? What are you doing?
Just going to be speaking, that's all. Mm-hmm.
What is the topic you're speaking on?
About China up in the Arctic and how it affects Alaska. And to the World Affairs Council of Anchorage.
The World Affairs Council of Anchorage. Well, mm-hmm. that's interesting. How mm-hmm. does what is China doing up in the Arctic? Anything constructive?
No. It's declared itself basically something called a near Arctic nation, which gives it a right to basically get itself up there and start taking things as it can. It laid the groundwork for that and started the initial steps. So there's really no part of the globe that's not of interest to China, and Alaska is in the mix as well.
I don't want to steal your thunder, but is China a threat to Alaska? Should we be concerned?
Well, I'd say not tomorrow.
Right.
But up in the Arctic region in particular, China definitely has interests and is making a claim to it, to parts of it. Partly sees it as a transportation route, an easier one over to Europe, but there's also a lot of resources there. And then there's also just the fact it's somewhere on the planet that is potentially seizable.
So might we see a nine dash line up in the Arctic?
You might. You might see it included into something like a nine dash line on the grounds that some Chinese person once laid eyes on it at some point. but it's good to think of these things as sort of opportunistic, and wherever China can insinuate itself, it'll make an effort. So it's sort of pushing everywhere, seeing where there's, as the expression goes, where there's bone and where there's flesh. And wherever there's flesh, it stabs harder.
All right. Well, that should surprise anybody who even slightly pays attention, not one bit. So, all right. Have you spent much time in Alaska? Do you enjoy Alaska?
The short answer is no. I've only been there once, I think, but I did enjoy it. It's really a striking place. It's not like anywhere else. It's not like Colorado or such. It's just everything's bigger. The scale of everything is bigger. It's like a really cold Texas, I suppose, but visually more interesting.
I've been there twice, going to Okinawa in 1985, I think it was, and then coming back from Afghanistan. For whatever reason, the Russians let us overfly their airspace, and we got to go the short route instead of the long route. So from Kyrgyzstan or something like that to the home of, like, Genghis Khan, and then over the Pacific to Alaska. And cell phone service there for the first time in a year, which was really exciting. But I've never actually got out and spent any time in the city. But everybody I know that was stationed up there talks about the absolute mind-blowing majesty of Alaska. So will you get out and get a chance to experience any of that? Or are you speaking and leaving?
No, yeah, not a whole lot. But, it's so big you can only see a little bit. But I won't get out too much. Plus it is wintertime, so... the majesty is a pretty good word for it, I think.
Yeah, it's not a word that I use often, just so everybody knows. Here's a question for you. I was back in D.C. the last week, I accompanied my son and his wife and my grandson to the Smithsonian, National Air and Space Museum out at Dulles Air Force Base, out near Dulles. Have you been?
No, I know of it, and I've heard that it's well worth a visit.
Oh, my God. They had me at hello, but they, the Enola Gay's in there. And I'm talking to a guy about the Enola Gay, and he said, actually, that's the bomb site used in the bombing run. I said, what? He said, yeah. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. So, yeah, I would tell you, anybody who, if you've never been, schedule the better part of the day and go out. It is absolutely mind-blowing, the stuff you'll see out there, one-of-a-kind stuff in the world, you know, like German and Japanese aviation stuff that is on exhibit at the Smithsonian. And then the Space Shuttle Discovery is there. And, oh, man, I didn't realize that was as big as it was. And then you look at the Gemini space capsule that they put on top of a rocket and sent somebody. I said, yeah, that took no small amount of courage to get on that and say, let's go, boys, let's do this. And so it's a pretty interesting place. So I would recommend it to you.
Well, next time. But, yeah, I go by it all the time when I'm there. And I always think I should stop and always wonder how it's actually pronounced, given the name. But I haven't yet, one of these days.
You should stop and go and forego a Nationals baseball game for the museum, which I would rarely tell anybody to do. But I assure you. It will be well worth your while. Well worth your while. All right, let's talk about the Western Pacific. The United States and the UK jointly patrolling the South China Sea. When will Japan join them? When will Australia join them? And why has it taken so long for that to happen?
I think the Australians would probably get involved first before Japan. Japan's still a little leery, and I think would prefer to do things it by itself. They send ships through, submarines through, but it's still a little leery. But it has, in fact, recently done, a brief exercise with a Navy ship down in the South China Sea. So it sort of already has started tentatively doing things. How much more it's going to do, I don't know. But now that I think about it, wasn't all that long ago, say a month or two. I think when one of the Japanese ships was transiting the South China Sea, it sort of linked up with an American ship from Seventh Fleet, American ship or two, and it sort of made it clear that that's what they were doing. They didn't try to hide it. It's kind of coming, but with these things, you sort of there's a tendency to expect them the frequency or the numbers of these joint operations and the scale. One tends to imagine that it would naturally increase. You'd more of it, more complex things, more often. But it doesn't seem to always work that way. It just sort of they do something and then they just now and then do something else. Doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't expect it to get too busy too soon, but nonetheless, anything is something. It is a lot more than was being done in previous administrations. The Australians, they have some domestic politics as well, where there is a sort of an appeasement faction in Australia, some of it directly on the Australian payroll, some of it based on the belief that in order to preserve the economic chain or interchange with or the business dealings with China, you have to stand back on the security front. And so that shaped, there's domestic politics at work in Australia, but they have, I think, stood up pretty well in South China Sea and have even tried to do some things with Japan, but particularly in the South China Sea, I have not folded, and I think have more than most, and maybe more than anyone, have stood up. The Japanese as well, you do have a similar dynamic where there is an appeasement faction or a pro-China business faction which doesn't want to do anything to upset the Chinese. Yeah. But Abe does have a different opinion. He reflects a different opinion in the Japanese political world. And so that's why Japan, while it has made some signs of making nice with China in recent months, hasn't stopped sending its ships around the region and nor cooperating with the United States in that area. So it's sort of moving in the right direction, at least in the sense of people standing up for themselves. But once again, there's a lot more to be done, but it also does face a pretty big adversary now.
That is the way the Chinese work, though, right? Get our economy embedded and yours dependent on ours, and then threaten to choke it off, and that way you will not get in our way. But I'm at least encouraged, as you kind of pointed out, that it's better than what we had been doing. I mean, so I don't think we're like standing up completely on our back legs yet, but we are emerging from it. And I just think the significance of it is, if and when the United States, Australia, the Japanese, the South Koreans, and the Brits patrol that area on, I don't care, however infrequent basis, I think it's a great message to send that, hey, look, we together, it's not much of a contest, no matter what you may think, against us together. So why don't we sit down and why don't we at least attempt to act like adults and get to some kind of reasonable conclusion on this, which would mean you stop with the stupid stuff that you're doing. And I think that the sooner we get to that spot, the better it is for everybody and the better it is for everybody's economy. I just curious.
I agree. You've laid out the Chinese MO very well, how they do things.
I learned it from you.
Okay, I must have learned it from someone else, I'm sure. But also one way to look at what's going on in the South China Sea is sort of an effort to hold the line.
Right.
It's kind of unlikely that China's going to be pushed back or sort of retreat from the South China Sea. But while standing up there, you can apply particularly economic, political pressure elsewhere on different fronts.
Right.
And that's one way to look at what's going on there. It's not an end in itself or the only sort of front, but rather a place where you stand up and defend and as you can apply counter pressure. But you're also doing it in a lot of other places around the world. And as I noted, the economic, political, diplomatic, and propaganda fronts are as important, maybe even more so, and that's where you really can apply some effective pressure. Or not so much even applying pressure is not the way to look at it, but rather promoting your own interests. That's a better way to look at this. It isn't containing, that may be an outcome, but it's really just standing up and defending the civilized world's approach to things.
No, I well said. To me, and whatever they can do, these three nations can do jointly, I think they absolutely positively should do, because that is the solution to the Chinese pressure, is the combined effects of all those countries and them saying that way no single one has to take the brunt, although the Chinese will try to do that. But I think they're I wish the president, let me ask you about this. The president's actions relative to the Trans-Pacific trade agreement, okay? Was that a good thing for the United States? Was that a bad thing for the United States? And to me, if he believes that those treaties should be bilateral, I haven't seen anything being written that they're being negotiated. What is the effect of what he did? So, A, was it a good thing, in your opinion? B, the effect of what he did, plus minus. And am I wrong at saying that I've not seen any negotiations going on with Pacific Rim nations about trade? I've seen them going on with the Chinese, but that's all.
Hmm.
Three-part question there, sir.
Good question. I wish he had gone through with TPP. I see why he didn't, but and keep in mind that Hillary Clinton was opposed to it as well. So it's often presented as though here's this wild man who's upset everything, but Mrs. Clinton was as opposed to it as Mr. Trump is. I must say I wish they had gone through with it, and the reason is not so much economic. I think when you calculate that, it's kind of a wash, and you know it. In terms of how much, what the benefits would actually be economically for the United States. Maybe a marginal improvement over time, but not, you know, it's not the end of the world either way. But I thought that politically, that was the important thing. You had some momentum going for a coalition of really varied nations, a range of different nations, that were getting together and saying, this is how we're going to do business. These are going to be the rules for international trade amongst us and by extension, international trade in general. And these were rules that the People's Republic of China cannot meet. They either can't or will refuse to play by them. And here you had a large chunk of the region actually saying, well, these are going to be our rules. If you want to join, you got to change. And it also, the United States was in a position of being sort of, once again, the leader in all of this. And that's important psychologically. Not a sign of commitment is one thing, but also as people looking to the United States to take the lead and to be convinced that it is still a real Asian power, that it's active, it's not stepping back from things. And this is, of course, contrary to the Chinese propaganda that the Americans are in decline, China's in the ascendancy, you might as well cut a deal while you can, or the best deal you can while you can. And TPP was sort of a challenge to that notion, and there were, I think, a number of nations in Asia that were sort of counting on America to keep active here and to stay with TPP and take the lead, and they didn't. The Americans didn't, and so I think it was a lost opportunity politically. Economically, that the economic benefits, one can debate that a lot, particularly if you read it in some detail. It looks like the lobbyists for certain U.S. industries actually helped draft some of the text. I think it's what you might call special pleading. But that said, I think it would have been a good thing to stick with it, and I wish they would perhaps come up with something in some way, sort of finesse the issue and either get back involved or call it something else or what have you. But I've noted there have been some bilateral renegotiations with the South Koreans. I think they're just starting with the Japanese, who've sort of dragged their feet, and maybe understandably. But you're right. There hasn't been a series of bilateral deals that I'm aware of, or bilateral negotiations to sort of replace TPP from an American perspective. So it's just left a vacuum. I think it's a lost opportunity. There's been a lot of momentum lost as a result of this. And once again, it's not the economic benefits. I'm not sure anybody in so-called flyover country or the Rust Belt would notice much of them. But the political, psychological aspect was significant. And I think it's unfortunate that it was squandered. Right. I think that probably is the right word.
So to summarize, so the economic fallout could be argued. However, the political and the leadership argument, the United States would probably lose, with people hoping to the United States stayed engaged as a sign of its commitment to the region, and so not being as engaged, probably not a good thing for us politically or in terms of leadership in the region.
That's right. And you know, as I noted, there's also I forget what I was going to say just as it's there is that sign that the U.S. is engaged in all of this. But also another important thing that I think I touched on is that it laid out a set of rules that are what I would call fair rules for international trade. And one of the complaints about this current system is that China was let into the World Trade Organization with a lot of exemptions, without having to play by the rules everyone else does. The TPP's rules are the rules. And so China would not get into TPP because it doesn't play by those rules. So it was excluding China from this agreement. And that was a good thing because it presents a, once again, sort of resets things and says, look, this is how things should be. This is how we're going to enforce things. And if you want in, you're going to have to accommodate. We are not going to accommodate China or anyone else to let them in with their own set of rules while we play by these other rules. And that was one of the real benefits here. I spoke at a thing once in Osaka, in fact, and so in the question and on TPP. And in the question and answer period, somebody asked, one of the questions was, well, how can TPP succeed without China involved? And it was one of those great questions you rarely get. And the answer was, well, TPP cannot succeed with China involved. And that's one way to look at it.
All right. Kind of along that line, a little bit different, though. The economic fight between the United States and China. Who is winning that, right? We've seen reports both here in the United States and from out of China talking about the damage that's been done to both nations economically, and you'll see various articles that say, but it's having a greater impact on President Xi and China, whose economy is slowing down, which is never a good thing for them. And then you'll read the same thing about the United States and the Western world. Do you have an opinion about all that? And what, if you could get your crystal ball out, what do you see in the future? How does this dance get resolved? Because, and which is very much, you know, you just kind of teased it when you talked about, you know, China's been allowed into the WTO, you know, in like an anomaly. It is certainly not the nation that it was when it was allowed in, yet it doesn't seem like anybody's in a hurry to amend that stuff. So it seems like there's a similar theme that China does not have to want to have to pay the freight that everybody else does in relative to the world economy. What is your take on who's experiencing more pain, and what is your take on when you look into your crystal ball, how does it get resolved?
My sense of it is that China's in bigger trouble than us at the moment. You know, I think you might one way to look at it is a boxing match, and one side, which is us, is just getting hammered against the ropes and getting hammered. And suddenly we land a punch that staggers the other guy. And suddenly we get a little more life, and somehow you just get some more life to you. And you just smack the guy and really hurt him and maybe landed another blow. And now you're back on your feet again and sort of got back and come to your senses. Sort of, just about.
Right.
And that's about where we are. So it's not as if the game's over. We've got on the offensive and everything's, you know, we're going to win for sure. But we have punched back very effectively since the Trump administration came in. And that's, I think, not a bad analogy. Where we are, so what happens depends on what we do from now on. If we continue both the offensive, but also a good defense as well. And I think that's where we've done, well, the Trump administration has done pretty well. It has put on, the trade tariffs have been effective. Also, but even as effective or more, is going after some Chinese companies and Chinese behavior when it comes to intellectual property theft, stealing trade secrets, unfair behavior, breaking sanctions as well. This has an effect on the Chinese economy. And one thing way to look at this is that the Trump administration has targeted one of the key Chinese vulnerabilities, and that is that the Chinese government, for it to be able to do whatever it wants to do in China and particularly overseas, that it needs foreign exchange.
Right.
The Chinese money, the yuan, is not convertible, which means that nobody really wants it. As Americans and using dollars, we're so used to everybody, you know, a dollar being good anywhere on the planet. Chinese money is not. And that is a big difference. And so for the Chinese government to do things or to pay for things, particularly, say, once again, overseas in particular, where it has to come up with money that somebody wants, U.S. dollars, Japanese yen, euros, etc. And if it can't earn those, it doesn't have enough money for that to do what it wants to do. And so it's like a big, really big Zimbabwe.
Right.
You can kind of understand it on the Zimbabwe scale, where those countries don't have dollars. They can't do anything. They can't buy food, anything. China's not in as bad a situation, but it is dependent on foreign exchange. And that is where the tariffs have hit the Chinese, because they're not making as much money. Also, by pointing out the dangers of dealing, of operating in the Chinese market, which have been clear to everybody for a long time, people just choose to ignore it, that reduces the amount of foreign companies investing in China, which once again reduces the amount of foreign currency available to the Chinese government. And all of this has an effect of discombobulating both the Chinese leadership, but also the people in general, the citizens in general, as their economy slows. And unemployment is much worse in China, for example, than officially reported, where it's said to be like 4%,
right,
something like that. It's probably closer to 20, as some would say. So there's a lot. Once you get the citizenry worried or unhappy, that causes real problems, and that's where causes problems for the Chinese Communist Party, and that's where all this trade pressure really has an effect, is both in specifically in reducing the amount of foreign currency, foreign exchange available to the Chinese government, but also in just helping to slow the economy. And thus really create some discontent. The Chinese economy has, of course, always had some inherent problems that have been obvious to anybody. Not least, there's no property rights, basically. A contract means only what Xi Jinping says it does. It's not like here where you take a contract to court and it gets enforced as written. So there's always been, and plus state-owned enterprises are inefficient. They drain money that could be put to better uses. But it's had some real problems, despite what a lot of the commentators and Thomas Friedman have been saying. So you take these internal inherent problems in China and in China's economy, and then you apply some pressure in the form Mr. Trump has been, particularly as it applies to China's export activities and its overseas operations. And then you're being effective. And that's what has really started. It's kind of late. It's only been going on for a couple of years now. But one important thing, how will this continue? Hard to say. You know, it is a multi-round boxing match, and one wonders if it will last beyond Mr. Trump, either 2 or 6 years. But it might go even longer, because you do notice that even Democrats, this is probably the only thing that they're kind of in agreement with the Republicans on, and that is the need to stand up to Chinese predation. And so that is some grounds for optimism. Of course, Wall Street and some major American companies would smell short-term profits, or, you know, want to reach an agreement to just go back to to what it was, the status quo, put us back on the ropes and start taking some blows again. But overall, there has been, I think, a sea change in the approach of U.S. political world, and also the business world as well.
And the sea change is that this short-term pain is required to get to a better, more secure place economically with the Chinese, which would then enable sustained growth as they, you know, get brought into the fold of developed nations and the way they behave economically, as opposed to this kind of gangster thug that rolls around the world and does what it does in this special capacity under the WTO and other economic agreements?
Though it's not too confident about saying America can absorb short-term pain. Our economy is in pretty good shape, which
right.
makes it easier
yes.
To apply pressure on China. And I'm not sure just how it would be if there was some, if it looked like what we were doing to China was causing us a lot of harm. That's not the case at the moment. But there, this sort of a general agreement between the parties is important. And there's also a sense that I think more people are seeing the damage that's been caused.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons for this bilateral agreement. But there's also, I forgot to mention it, that there have been charges and valid charges raised of Chinese spying, both intellectual property theft, but also electronic spying via Chinese IT companies, most prominently Huawei, one called ZTE, but Huawei in particular. And that there's real fear that these have been used to sort of insinuate Chinese intelligence capabilities into the electronic backbone of the world, especially when you have Huawei having really been subsidized to the point it is able to has been able to undercut most of its competition in electronic infrastructure building. Telecom infrastructure building for at least the last decade. And that is a real serious concern. It's finally being recognized and admitted to by a lot of countries, and countries that matter, and even some that aren't so important. There is this concern of Chinese spying through their companies, and telecom companies in particular, has made more people, more businesses, more countries leery of dealing with China, with these companies. And these are important companies to China. And that's an important thing, not just leery. The Americans have some laws against it. So when you prohibit those companies prohibit American companies from dealing with those companies and using their equipment, that does have a serious economic effect. And even some of the Europeans, like the Czechs, the Germans, the British to a degree, and the Australians and even New Zealand, some of these countries have actually backed off from these particular Chinese companies and that hardware. And that has a cumulative economic effect on those companies and on China writ large, which is damaging.
Were you surprised when those charges were announced? I honestly was a bit surprised that the United States has taken that aggressive an approach to this issue. I mean, to me, it's long overdue, and I would say it's simply pointing out the obvious, you know, and looking the other way is pretty gross when you begin to do a little bit of research at it, even just on the unclassified side. But were you surprised when the United States initially unsealed the indictment and then it went further here, what, a week, 10 days ago?
Not really. I think the Trump administration has shown itself willing to stand up. And so I wasn't all that surprised. I thought, just once again say, well, it's about time, but they've done enough things already that would have been considered just impossible under the Obama, Bush, Clinton administrations and previous ones. So I'm not, see, this, this wasn't surprising. I thought it was a good thing to see. The timing of the specific charges against Huawei was, I think, not coincidental. It was almost the same day that a high-powered Chinese trade negotiation arrived in Washington that the administration unveiled the specific charges against the company, and not just individuals, but the company itself. and particularly for intellectual property theft. And it's a detailed account, a detailed charge, and it makes good reading to give you a sense of just how the company and Chinese intellectual property espionage operates. In this particular case, one of the most brazen aspects of it was Huawei internally they were sort of offering bonuses to people who stole the best technology or best intellectual property from other companies, particularly Western companies and particularly American companies. Not just American. They were pretty much global in their desire to steal. And they have, it's usually in a company, it's like a contest to see who sells the most Girl Scout cookies or something. This was to see who could steal the best technology from other companies. And what do you say? You know, this is really barbaric behavior. You know, not at all civilized nor how things work. But that's, you know, you have that China's flagship company, and that's how they did business and still do. And that's one of the reasons why the Trump administration has brought America to its senses and is saying, well, this isn't how it should be. Just imagine that. You know, why did it take 20, 30 years to get to this point?
Well, answer that. I mean, is it why? I mean, it's clearly the path this takes the United States down, and this is not a good path. What is the argument not to call them out on this stuff?
Well, you might distill it down to, well, there's still this allure, this mirage of selling one of something to every Chinese person. And that belief has been around since at least the 1840s or 1850s, probably longer. And it's this insanity that the Chinese market is so just unimaginably lucrative that a company has to be in it, and it has to put up with whatever the Chinese do to that company just for in the hopes of being allowed to sell its products. And all that is suicide. You're basically giving up your technology, your intellectual property, the thing that really that is valuable to you, in exchange for this belief, sort of wimpy and his hamburgers, that I will gladly pay you Thursday for a hamburger today. And the foreigners always lose. There's a degree of hubris involved here, and also condescension towards the Chinese that I think has been around for a long time. And I first got a whiff of it in the early 90s when one of the presidents of one of the Hughes Group companies, so it was Aviation Electronics, as I recall, he was asked if he minded giving away technology to the Chinese in exchange for doing business there. And he said no, because Hughes will always be ahead of the Chinese. That is a condescending and stupid. And you can look and do some research and see where the Hughes Group is today. But that really represented a lot of the thinking, is that, well, we would always be ahead of them. The market is so lucrative, we have to be in there, even if the profits haven't come, or even if there are some, they might be short-term, even if we're building up the competition, even if the rules in China are stacked against us and discriminate against a foreign company. And there was the belief, particularly in academia and that sort of that foreign policy class, that by accommodating China, by tolerating its behavior and allowing it to just strip American and other companies of their intellectual property, that this would gradually somehow transform China into a more liberal, into a sort of democratic country,
right,
like a really big Canada. And so you had all these things working, and, you know, sort of to help take almost 40, 50 years for the really America and the West to allow itself to be economically gutted. I mean, this has been a transfer of wealth akin to sort of what OPEC did when the oil states got together and sort of extorted all that money from the West. And that's about the scale of the transfer of wealth that has taken place between America, the West, and Japan, and China. It's just basically been handed over without much of a complaint, really. And now a guy, a real estate developer from Queens, is the guy who's finally gotten America to do what it ought to be doing. You know, who would have imagined?
Yeah, it is. I honestly don't get, Grant, when you're the President of the United States and you have such tools at your disposal, I just don't understand why you would allow, first of all, the arrogance of the statement that you're talking about, like, yeah, Hughes will always be. Well, I think we're seeing that franchise, not only at risk, but if you believe the assessments of our intelligence communities, then you will see what they've said, and that is our technological advantage is about to be eclipsed, or at least be, you know, peered if we don't begin, you know, to secure our, you know, our own intellectual property and what we've worked so hard for. So I just honestly don't understand it. Do you have an explanation of it other than politically it's going to cause too much turmoil, and I don't want to go there with China? Is that where this gets laid?
It eventually came to that, but I think ultimately it was, we wanted the money that by selling stuff to them. And I think it, you know, tracks back to wanting the money. But there was in the beginning also a belief by particularly Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon and that crowd that by befriending China, by giving them what they want, you could split them off from the Soviet Union. And thus that would give us an advantage versus the Soviet Union. Maybe there was an argument for that. I don't think they went about it the right way, if there was such an argument. But over time, that was no longer an issue, particularly once the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union fell with it. So there was, that was a long 30 years ago now almost, and there was really no, at that point, people should have wised up, but they just kept going with it, and at some point it kicked into the, you know, make a lot of money by helping the Chinese economy develop, and it also reduces the military risks because everyone knows freer, more democratic nations don't go to war with each other. So it switched from, it was kind of an argument during the Nixon-Kissinger era, but that ended pretty quickly. And at that point, as I say, it switched over to make as much money and in the belief, the rationalization that if you allow China to develop, the military threat reduces. And then once the Chinese military started building up and getting more capable, then you started to hear, well, if we can't do anything to the Chinese because that will cause military problems. You know, they'll, who knows what they will do if they feel afraid now that they have this good, useful military. Who knows what they will do to their neighbors if we pressure them on trade. And that was another reason for backing off. And then once they got, you know, a lot of nuclear weapons, good missiles, they had those for a long time. But then you start to hear the argument, well, we can't have chaos in China, because who knows what they will do since they have these weapons. That was another excuse for doing nothing. Then, even during the Obama administration, one excuse for doing nothing was that it was a distraction from the effort that he needed to put into a national health plan. So anything China does, de-escalate. That was the position, which means appease, back off. And so there's always been a reason not to do anything, but it's the reasons have shifted over time. And now they're kind of running out of reasons because I think everything that's been tried, it's most people can kind of even have kind of see it hasn't worked. And even the crowd which was arguing all these positions that I've just laid out, even they are finally saying, wow, this China that – we need to do something different. We need to challenge China. Very few of them are saying, yes, and I was wrong. It's always as if, well, just magically, one day the scales fell off of every single person's eyes and now behold China as an enemy or an adversary. Whereas there's been people saying this for a long time, have been recommending correct, better policies. They've been isolated, ostracized, ridiculed, humiliated, professionally disadvantaged. And now the people who did all that to them, they all are claiming, well, nobody could have seen it, and so it's like, never mind. But that's just some of the background as I see it.
Grant Newsham, my guest, former intel officer in the Marine Corps. He is a man around the Western Pacific. And Grant, tell everybody where they can find your stuff in terms of, I mean, you. I'd start to list them, but I'd leave something out. So tell everybody where you're writing these days.
Well, I write in a few main places. One is Asia Times. Right. Another one is the National Interest. And I had one just the other day about U.S.-China trade issues in a new outfit called AND Magazine, A-N-D Magazine, which has some good stuff.
Right.
And that's, I think, it's a pretty good article. I think it's pretty funny in places, but it tries to call spades spades. It's one of the reasons I don't get invited to so many places.
the truth. Yeah, it's such a pain in the ass.
That's pretty good. And then there's a Japanese outfit. It's in English called Japan Forward. Japan Forward, which is in part of the Sankei newspaper group, which is one of Japan's biggest papers. And they wanted something, and they have a sort of an English outlet to help non-Japanese speakers sort of get a sense of Japan and Japanese positions on things or issues that affect Japan. And they don't mind being critical of Japan either. So those are a few places that I've get things in reasonably often.
All right. I want to touch one more thing before you get away from me today, Grant. Email Mac. What's the current time in Anchorage if the current time on the West Coast is 8:45 ish? So what time is the current time in Anchorage?
It's almost the West Coast. It's 7:45.
Nice, very nice. This may be the closest we've ever been.
Yeah, kind of a change.
Exactly. Normally, it's very, very different. Rumblings about a second North Korean United States summit, and you have people like Jack Keane, who is prominent commentator on Fox, saying, "I don't really know what they've done to merit such a summit." Clearly, they get great benefits of this. The North Koreans do. They occupy the world stage with President of the United States. Yet it doesn't seem like much progress has been made, much tangible progress that would signal a reason to do this again. Your thoughts on that?
Well, we'll see. No matter what administration it is, I like to give them the benefit of the doubt. They're the ones sort of in the ring and with the information, with the expertise, they're the ones closest to these issues and are trying to, do according to their, usually their highest sense of what's right. Trying to figure out some way to resolve these issues. So I'd like to give them a break and see what, it's maybe something I wouldn't do, but, it's their chance to sort of resolve things, to do something useful for the country. When the Obama administration, for example, dealt with Cuba, I wouldn't have done it, and I certainly wouldn't have cut the deal they did, and I think one legitimately criticizes that. The same with their Iran deal. Which is not one that I would have either pursued nor handed over $150 billion to the Iranians. I wouldn't have done it, but it is that every administration deserves the, I think a degree of sort of the benefit of the doubt. And, we can have our own opinions and hold them pretty strongly about how we think these will help out or will work out or even whether they should be doing what they're doing. What I would say is let's see. In this case, just one, I'm kind of curious, just out of what I would call as liberal arts curiosity, just to see what happens when Mr. Trump gets in a room with Kim. But that's beyond that. Would I have required more from North Korea? Maybe, but at the same time, you know, from the position I look at it, you know, I've only got partial information. And I, you know, it's not up to me to put together an overarching strategy to sort of promote for, to defend U.S. interests. So I assume that any administration has got all of those. So once again, they could be really wrong. But, you know, as I said, I'm inclined to give Mr. Trump the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, if he and his people have decided this is worth meeting, well, okay. But then if they do, then they do have an obligation to come up with something, have it produce something, have that there be some useful results from it. And the useful results can vary from person to person, of course. But if he wants to meet, well, that's fine with me. I might have, if I was being asked for advice from my perspective here, I'd probably give him a few different ideas or things he might insist on. But we'll see. If they want to meet, fine. But the administration does have an obligation at some point to point to some real results and good results from any sort of foreign policy initiative that it makes. And if it fails, then it's. I think it should not be afraid to change course. You don't see that very often, is that admission of sort of defeat or failure tends to have domestic political ramifications. But I wish more administrations would say, look, we tried, it didn't work, so this is what we're going to do. You don't seem to hear that much. So we'll see.
All right. We'll see. Well, you know, again, you and I talked before, and you know, it was certainly better that we were talking than the North Koreans shooting missiles, you know, over Japan and going to target adjacent to Guam and all of the rest of that. Talking is certainly better than that. And so I to me, it's like, you know, talk and see what comes of it. And I don't know that I would be in too great of a hurry to end that, because he's not, you know, executing the other behaviors. But at the same time, I would want to see a halt to their efforts in terms of missile development, missile test site development, and things like that. So interesting. What do you, final question, what are you writing on next? What are we going to see from you next?
Thinking about it, I think something on this, the Malaysian financial scandal, one MDB, and where the basically the previous Malaysian administration kind of stole about $5 or $6 billion from there. It's a national development fund, and they were aided and abetted in this by Goldman Sachs, not surprisingly. And I've just got sort of some ideas on there and what happened. And my point is that Goldman Sachs claims, of course, some employees tricked them, but I think Goldman Sachs did it because they wanted to do it, and they wanted to make $600 million from dealing with the Malaysian administration. So that's what I'm writing about.
Mm-hmm. How do they move the money? How do they move those quantities of money? Do they funnel it in terms of billing and payments to false companies? How did they actually do it right?
It was all above board. They, you know, it looked like a bond sale. You know, the Malaysian government sold bonds. And to arrange all that, private companies will do that. And that's where Goldman Sachs does. That's one of their business lines.
Right.
Is they arranged it all for them. But they basically, the idea behind it all was a way to, for the administration basically to steal, as I say, $5-6 billion. And, the Malaysian government would like some of the money back. And they've asked Goldman Sachs to give back the $600 million in fees. So it's really a good example of how, how financial companies, will do things they shouldn't do because they smell so much money. And the funny thing is that they could have avoided it really easily. If all they had to do is they just had to send somebody to Kuala Lumpur, have them get in any taxi at the airport driven by any driver and ask him if they should do business with the Prime Minister of Malaysia at that time. and every one of them would have said no. I'm sort of being a little glib funny there, but this was an easy one to turn down with even a modest amount of research. But I suspect the top people at Goldman Sachs knew exactly what was going on, but were able to convince themselves that it was okay.
Well, I think, you know, if you were in that business and you put your hand up every time that you saw something that was out of place, you would certainly be limiting your business reach, I would think. You would substantially limit your business reach if you stopped doing business with different entities. So who gets on the list?
Well, that's the argument. You hear it a lot, but it's I think it doesn't withstand examination.
Right.
I think over time, when you get involved with those kind of deals, those kind of people, the ultimate punishment tends to outweigh whatever profits you made from a particular deal or two. And once the regulators go after you and see you as a corrupt company, that doesn't help you either. And you get punished for that. You get a reputation as either being too stupid to spot bad customers or bad deals, or not caring, neither of which is very good to have. And in fact, I asked a guy, the president of a pretty prominent financial firm once, if he minded giving up business because he didn't want to deal with sort of unethical transactions or unethical people. And he says no, because people see what kind of company we are. And as a result, we get more business And that always struck with me. And that was actually a Wall Street firm. And it shows that you can run a clean operation and make a lot of business, get a lot of money, and do a lot of business. But it takes some effort. And I don't think that that is exactly industry practice at the time. But it is really, and also if you take the right approach, you can actually navigate around these pitfalls and these dangers. And as I say, that having a reputation for being both smart and honest does tend to help you in the long run, is even in the financial sector, has been my sense of things. So it's it's not industry practice as I see it.
Got it. And because we see it happening all the time. Grant Newsham has been our guest. Grant, first of all, thank you very much. Enjoy Anchorage. Good luck in giving your speech. And we will catch up with you in the not-too-distant future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
No, always a pleasure, Grant. Thank you for making us all smarter. We appreciate it.
Okay. Nice.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a Monday. Been a while. First time in 2019 that we spoke to him. Grant Newsham. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, the Gunner will join us as we roll along here on a Monday. Yeah, first time back in Studio One. Don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.